Tonight on Coast to Coast, the induction of after-death communications. Our special guest, Dr. Alan Botkin. Later on, we'll be joined by another guest as well, Henya Stromberg. So get ready for all of this in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Alan Botkin, a licensed clinical psychologist with more than 20 years of experience in treating patients who suffer from grief and traumatic loss. Well, he's made a groundbreaking discovery. He found as a result of experimenting with variations of a relatively new and very powerful psychological procedure called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing that he could reliably induce in his patients an experience that they believed was actual contact with the deceased person that they were grieving. Dr. Botkin's discovery, which he calls induced after-death communication, or simply IADC, makes these experiences available to virtually everyone. His website linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to talk about his work, Reconnections, the induction of after-death communications in clinical practice. He's our guest back on Coast to Coast, Dr. Alan Botkin. Hello, doctor. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Later on, we're going to bring in Henya as well, and I'll let you lead into that toward the half-hour mark tonight, Doctor. You know, this is an interesting series of events that you call IADC. Is anybody else involved in this, or is this groundbreaking here?
Well, it's groundbreaking in the sense that this procedure that I stumbled into is very unique in terms of the approach. I'm not the first to successfully induce after-death communications with any reliability. The first was Raymond Moody.
Yes.
And he described his work in his book Reunions and his psychomantium procedure.
All right, now tell me, how did you stumble into this?
Well, I was working at a VA hospital on a PTSD unit, that's post-traumatic stress disorder, with combat veterans who were suffering the psychological effects of their wars they participated in. And the work for us was very grueling for many years until this new therapy came out, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR. It came out in the early 90s, or it actually first came out in the late 80s. We began using it in the early 90s. And this EMDR was absolutely remarkable. It changed the way we did business. For the first time, we could actually help our patients find relief and take the reliving component out of the memory. In other words, people with traumatic memories, they not only remember what happened, they also relive what happened. And so if a trauma happened 30 years ago, when a person thinks about that, they not only remember it, but it feels like it's happening all over again.
Okay, but this is not hypnosis, right?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, those who are trained in both hypnosis and EMDR actually think of the two as opposites. Hypnosis gets people in a relaxed, focused state, and it also increases suggestibility and so on. The brain waves are slower with hypnosis, and those brain changes increase suggestibility of the subject. EMDR, on the other hand, the brain waves are the same as waking consciousness. People are very alert throughout it. EMDR actually increases brain processing and promotes integration of various brain parts.
No.
Similar to what our brains do when we dream at night, when we experience rapid eye movement or REM sleep. And the discovery of EMDR seems to be that we can tap into that same mechanism, that same speedy processing that occurs during dream sleep. It's that increased processing during dreaming has been believed to cause our eyes to shift back and forth.
Well, what is it about the rapid eye movement, or as we call desensitization, that creates this experience? Is it working on the brain? What is it?
Well, that's a good point, and the answer is not simple. EMDR, while it increases this rapid processing and allows the brain to integrate traumatic memories, I began using it in a very different way about 10 years ago, and I started experimenting with it, and I started making a number of changes to it. I had no idea where my changes were leading me, but after a number of significant technical changes to the procedure, my patients began reporting these after-death communications.
Okay, let's get into the specifics, too. How did your patients come to you via this entire situation, the induction of after-death communications, or did you go seek them out?
Oh, no. I was working in a VA hospital,
right,
and I was working with PTSD patients from Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, even some World War II guys, and they came to see me to do trauma work. They were not seeking after-death communication.
Okay, all right, I understand. You know, I just got done taping a series on ghosts and spirits for sci-fi, which was the pilot portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to tell you, the interest in the spirit world is absolutely staggering, Alan. I mean, it is. I think it's at an all-time high.
That's the way it seems to me.
Why? Do you think it's because people are so concerned about their dearly departed? Do you think it's because they're afraid of demons and possessions? Why do you think so many people are interested in this now?
Well, I give a lot of credit to Raymond Moody and some of the early workers in the field of near-death experience. When those stories started to break and people started writing books and so on back in the 70s, I think that got a lot of people's interest. And the after-death communication experience was something that that followed and also became popular. But it became clear that a very large number of people were having experiences that they were convinced were true glimpses into the other side. And their stories were pretty remarkable and not easily explained away by modern science.
Okay, let's create a few examples, if you would, to give us a better perspective of how this works, what people see or feel when it's all done.
Okay.
All right.
The procedure, I always begin the procedure by using the eye movements to help people process their deep sadness, all right? And it's generally the sadness that people experience blocks them from being able to have an after-death communication. First of all, after-death communications are not at all rare, and they've been estimated to occur in 20% of in people. So one out of five people have already had an after-death communication.
All right, through this technique, or it just happens?
Just happens.
All right.
Spontaneously and randomly. Now, when I use this procedure with my patients, we first do a lot of work on, like I say, processing that deep sadness and other emotional issues that prevent one from having the experience. And then, at the very end of my procedure, I use the eye movement to put a person in a state that I call the receptive mode, where they're just kind of open to anything that happens. As a matter of fact, that's how I originally discovered it. After making a number of changes to the eye movement procedure, I just gave people an extra set of eye movement. And when they closed their eyes, they would have the experience. And by the way, I just want to make it clear, people who have induced after-death communications, they're private experiences that people have with their eyes closed.
Hmm. Okay, let's assume, okay, I come in as a patient. What do you do with me?
Well, the very first thing I do is I take you through a fairly lengthy screening procedure to make sure that this procedure is appropriate for you. But the very first thing we would do would be to identify your primary loss And then you would tell me the story. And after you get done telling me the story of your loss and this person and so on, I would use the eye movement while I would have you shift your eyes while focusing on your sadness associated with the loss.
Okay, now how do we do that?
Well, you're sitting in a chair in front of me, and I ask you simply just to get in touch with your sadness.
Mentally, I guess. We got to just concentrate.
Just allow yourself to feel that sadness. And then while you're feeling that sadness, I get your eyes shifting side to side in a particular rhythmic fashion.
How do you do that? We just do that with eye muscle, or do you have some kind of apparatus we have to follow?
There's a number of ways you can do it. You can just simply, I can, you know, wave my arm side to side when you focus on my fingers going back and forth. I have an arthritic shoulder, so I use a stick. A little easier for me to do.
Is this something, Alan, we should not do at home?
Yes, you should not do it at home because the eye movement, the good thing about it is that it's so powerful and really helps people process very painful things. The problem with eye movement or the potential side effects involve, most importantly, bringing up other distressing losses or traumas one has in one's life, bringing those up so inadvertently. So anytime that I work with somebody doing eye movement, I always need to get a good history first. In other words, somebody might want to come in and work on the death of their grandmother and have some significant sadness about that. But if they were in a terrible car accident 20 years prior, I'm going to be giving eye movement on the death of grandmother, and there's a real good chance we're going to pull up that accident. And that person then may begin to relive the accident. So if you're doing this on your own and you're trying to induce an ADC on yourself and you've got any other significant trauma in your life, there's an excellent chance that you're going to pull that up and end up in a very bad place. It should only be done by a competent professional who is trained in EMDR.
Right, which is very important because not a lot of them are.
Correct, although more and more professional therapists across the world now are getting EMDR trained, and it's becoming rapidly mainstreamed. The last I heard, there are 40,000 EMDR-trained professionals across the planet.
That's huge, I would think.
Yeah it is. And there have been a number of scientific studies. I believe it's over 20 now, controlled scientific studies that all support the efficacy of EMDR.
So, where do we stand in this country as opposed to other countries in this field?
Well, I probably couldn't give you a really good answer on that. EMDR started here in the United States and first began to grow here. But it's also now very big in Europe and Australia and so on.
All right, now, so these people are put into this state. Do they actually communicate with the dead, or do they think they are in order to solve their grief?
Well, that's an excellent question. As a psychologist, my primary concern has always been on the healing that's associated with induced after-death communication. And I've chosen not to speculate or take a side on whether this is real or not real and so on. I don't want to get bogged down in those arguments. My primary focus is on healing patients. Although, people are very interested if there is any evidence, if we have any evidence that would, argue that these experiences are real or not real and so on.
You know, in some dreams, two people will say sometimes, you know, my gosh, we had the same dream. I mean, I had a dream I was in his. He had a dream that, he was in mine. You know, it was that kind of thing. Is that the same way with these? Do people share these feelings or these thoughts?
Actually, yes. And this is one of the most unusual or startling aspects of IADC. It began, this discovery, this part of it was also discovered by a complete accident. When I was working at the VA hospital, I was inducing a patient, and I had a doctoral-level intern observing the procedure. And at one point, for some reason, he closed his eyes and gave himself eye movement. And I think at the time, if I remember right, he did it just to help himself relax a little bit. And what happened was, is he ended up eavesdropping in on my patient's ADC experience, and they had the exact same experience.
He popped right in.
He popped right in. Or actually, he wasn't in it, but he became an observer of the experience my patient was having.
Now, why is it so important for someone to have this communication? Is it closure? What is it?
Yes, it's closure. The real painful part of losing someone we love or care about is that it's a basic sense of disconnection from that person. It's a feeling that person's gone forever, and so on. When we lose somebody so important to us, you know, we lose a part of ourselves. You know, people say, I feel like there's a part of me missing now, and so on. What the after-death communication does is that it provides an experiential reconnection to the deceased, which does much to resolve that deep underlying sadness.
And if it works, it's probably well worth it, isn't it?
Yeah, and that is my primary concern, whether it works or not. And it works well, and it works wonderfully. And it really doesn't matter what people believe. I've worked with a large number of atheists and agnostics, and sometimes patients, when I introduce the procedure to some patients, they'll say, well, that's silly. It's not going to work on me. I don't believe in that stuff. And I ask them if they're willing to give it a try anyway, and they say, sure. And then when I take them through the procedure and they have the after-death communication experience, they're generally very surprised by it. And most of those people out of that atheist and agnostic group end up changing their beliefs.
What does science say about all this? Do they test this?
There are not well-controlled scientific studies that actually go after the issue, certainly whether these are real or not. But also, the IADC procedure is so new that it hasn't been adequately and completely scientifically studied yet. Professor Jan Holden at the University of North Texas and a number of her colleagues are about to undergo a series of research projects on IADC, and I'm very much looking forward to what they find. Hopefully other university departments across the country will pick it up as well. But that's going to be important for the development of IADC.
Tell me about Hanya. She's going to join us in a moment. Hanya Stromberg.
Hanya Stromberg is a social worker who lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She has had a practice there for a number of years. She came up to, I train people from all over the country. They come to see me for training in the IADC procedure. And I should point out that I can only train people in IADC who are already EMDR trained. I don't train people in the EMDR part.
Okay.
But since IADC is an offshoot of EMDR, I require that they are trained in that first. But anyway, Hanya came up to Chicago to get trained with me some time ago. It might be a couple years ago, and she went back to Albuquerque and began using IADC in her practice, and she is one of the better therapists that I have trained in IADC. She's highly skilled, very good at it, particularly good at the IADC procedure, but she's also very interesting because I mentioned that people sometimes share the IADC experience. They have the exact same experience at the same time. I have trained a number of therapists, or a handful of therapists, who seem to be able to experience what their patients are experiencing. Hanya is certainly the best at this and does that more consistently than anybody else I know.
Okay, well, let's bring her in when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And a lot of people checked out that UFO military website, and they said there's lots of stuff there. Lots of stuff indeed. Book signing coming up this Saturday in San Diego. I'll be there for Worker in the Light. It will be at the Claire de Lune Coffee Shop in San Diego. So those of you listening to us on Streamlink or at Kogo or on XM Satellite, come on by and say hi. Back in a moment. Okay, I'm going to bring in Hanya Stromberg now to join us with Dr. Alan Botkin. Hanya has worked in a variety of mental hospitals and clinics. Her experience prior to working in private medical practice, and practice indeed includes involvement with hospice organizations, consultations to an alcoholism and crisis center, teaching at the Santa Fe College of Natural Medicine. In the late 1970s, she met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and two of Ms. Ross's associates. This gave her the support of her ideals of working with the dying, and from 1980 through August of this year, she's been involved in her own psychotherapy practice and has worked with many people, helping them to find a way out of various forms of human misery, suffering, including intense grieving. In all of her therapy work, she has encouraged seeing the mystery behind the tribulations of life, supported the bereaved, the mourning, the traumatized, and the awareness of enduring bond between the living and the deceased, as she says, is a way toward healing their intense sadness and despair. Let's bring Hanya in now at Coast to Coast. Hello, Hanya. How are you?
Good evening, George.
Good to talk with
fine.
You. Now,
Hi, Hanya.
There you go. And I understand that you've retired from full-time psychotherapy practice,
yes,
right, Hanya?
I retired from my practice this past August. Due to my own health problem.
All right. Tell me your interest in the induction of after-death communications.
Well, I have always been very interested in death and dying. Since I was a child, I was born right after World War II in Poland, and it was a pledge to myself that I must understand death differently than the environment presented it to me. And the way it was presented to me, it was that death was horrific, and something in me disagreed with it. So this was a lifelong quest for me to understand death more. And so I have been involved with working with the dying, and had the good fortune to meet Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, a couple of her associates. And something that I like to mention here, that I'm not sure that how many people are aware of it, that Elizabeth was herself very, very interested in contacting the dead, the deceased, and she spent lots of energy doing that. Anyway, I have been an avid listener to Art Bell Show for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in 2002, I heard Dr. Al Botkin on Art Bell's show, and I was just trained in EMDR. My health at that time wasn't such that I could travel for training, but I dreamed of doing it.
Right.
And 2 years later, in March of 2004, I went to Chicago and trained with Al. And that has deeply, deeply enriched my life. And my work, I should say, I really piggybacked on Al's discovery and his tremendous work. I am tremendously in debt to Al for giving me this chance to work with people in deep grief and help them reconnect with the loved ones.
Well, your dream came true, Hanya. You were able to do this.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
For so many people, if you create the thought, sometimes that happens. When you got involved in this kind of work with Dr. Botkin and his work, did you expect the results that you're now getting and that he's getting with patients, and that is giving them the ability to get closure in their life and also giving them the ability to possibly communicate with the dead?
Well, when I went to train with Al, I was very interested in it, and I had immediate sense of confidence and could sense the good heart in Al. However, that wouldn't have been enough. I asked Al to induce me to have an experience, and I did have the very powerful experience with my own mother. The experience was amazing to me in this way that I am basically a very visual person. Mm-hmm. And in that experience, I could feel my mother hugging me, kissing me, which was completely unexpected. And what I experienced also with my own clients, that the experience is almost always not what one expects when it happens. It's always wonderful, but it's also almost always surprising.
That's an excellent point. And, that's one of the arguments, I think, that people aren't just making this up, imagining it, and it's not like just a wish fulfillment kind of thing. Because one of the hallmarks of the ADC experience is that people are very surprised by the content. It's very different from what they expect typically.
Yes, yes. And also something that I when I think of these experiences, well, I am moved how much people are helped. But there is also to me, I am tickled as I remember these experiences because there is so much humor that occurs on the part of the deceased.
Yeah, give us an example, Hanya.
For example, we had a client that a woman came heartbroken after the death of her husband, mm-hmm. and she was just living because of her daughter. And she did see her husband, and one of the first things that she saw was the cat that he brought with him, the cat that she was not very fond of, and he always teased her with it. And so she was laughing about it. It seems that the deceased come also is very much with the personalities like they had when they were in the body.
So that doesn't change. If someone was happy and jovial,
yes,
chances are in the afterlife,
right,
they'll be the same.
That's, in my experience, very much the same, and that their beliefs seldom change either.
Well, what do you feel, Hanya, is the most important thing about this kind of therapy in your life?
In my life?
Yeah.
In other people's lives?
Well, in yours and other people, because you did go through it.
Okay. Well, for myself, I would say, speak for everyone as I see it, for everybody. It's the reconnection with somebody that person feels they have lost forever. And there's a sense that that life continues beyond physical death, that love continues. So there is this visit, this reconnection that is so healing. And also what is so healing, I think that no matter what person believes, there is a sense that we are part of this one great awareness that really there is no disconnection between living and the dying. That it's almost as if the living were in the box of physicality, but life continues beyond it.
Okay, Ellen, in your opinion.
In my opinion.
Would you agree with what Hanya says?
Yes. I'm sitting here listening to Hanya, and Hanya puts it so beautifully. Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
Is this, Ellen, for the living or the dead?
Well, actually, we've done thousands of cases at this point, I and my trained colleague. And you know what? It seems to be for both.
I was going to say that, for both. Somehow it gives closure to the living, but it may also help that who has deceased.
Well, sometimes the deceased are experienced as having concern for pain they have caused in survivors. And guilt issues can be worked out, really both ways. We have even IADC'd abusive parents who were then experienced in the ADC as coming across as being very aware of the pain they caused and very interested in trying to help or fix those who survived.
Does everyone, I'll go for you first, Alan, and then you, Hanya, the people that you have, witnessed, does everyone go through this kind of induction of after-death communications when they go through this eye movement, or do some people it just doesn't work?
Well, when we use the IADC procedure, our goal is to induce the experience. At one point, when I first started working with IADC, my success rate was 98%.
Oh, that's huge.
I seriously thought I could induce just about everybody. And however, when I left the VA hospital and went into private practice, I found that my success rate dropped to about 70%. And I've probably thought more about that issue than any other issue to try to understand why it is I got that drop. And I think probably the main reason is that when I worked at the VA hospital, people came to see me to do trauma work, not to have the experience. But now in my private practice, people are coming to have the IADC experience. That makes it a little bit more difficult because people come excited about having the experience. I now get people who very much believe in this kind of stuff. The problem is beliefs and expectations, even if they're consistent with the experience, tend to get in the way, tend to block the experience. Because the very last part of the procedure, when the induction occurs, is I use the eye movement to enhance a receptive mode where people are just open to anything that happens.
How about you, Hanya? Did you ever get to a case where someone goes through this and they're sad or it doesn't work for them?
That the experience would not happen?
Mm-hmm. Or didn't happen?
I had out of probably between 50 and 60 cases that I have conducted, there were 3 cases that it did not happen at all. And I would say that 70% of the cases that's consistent with what Al presents are completely successful, and within the 30% are partial, but only 3 cases that there was completely no success.
Has anybody ever had a scary experience? I mean, something very strange happen?
Never in my practice.
Never. As a matter of fact, one of the points I make is that all induced after-death communication experiences are positive. In my favorite case, is I was inducing a patient who wanted to work on the loss of his brother. And when I took him through the procedure and then got to the end where I did the eye movement to induce the experience, when he closed his eyes, he immediately startled and opened his eyes and said there's a giant claw around his neck trying to kill him.
Jeez.
Well, I had had enough experience with IADC at that point that I was confident that he needed to go back and find out what that was. So he trusted me. And I gave him another set of eye movements, and he closed his eyes. And he then discovered that what that sensation was around his neck, it was his brother giving him a hug.
That was it?
That was it. And he misinterpreted that experience and, you know, put a negative twist on it. So there have been a couple occasions out of thousands of cases where at first, it may seem like something negative is about to happen or is happening, but when people go back, they find they misinterpret it. And so they're all positive, amazingly so.
Well, it sounds like a tremendous vehicle to help people. I mean, absolutely tremendous. How do they know who they're going to contact, though? What if someone has five dead relatives or five dead loved ones? How do they reach the one they want to?
Well, that's we generally start with the loss that's most distressing to the person. And then when the first part of the procedure is eye moving, that deep sadness, and when we get to the end of it and we do the induction, it's interesting that the person that my client is interested in connecting with is always the one that's there. It's never somebody completely different. But if those five deceased people are all family and connected in that way, what often happens is we're just trying to induce one family member, and in the experience, the whole family shows up. That's not at all rare and actually fairly common.
Let me ask you, Hanya, you know, in your therapy sessions, were you different from some of the other people who've gone through training programs? Did you change or alter the techniques at all?
No. My technique is pretty much the same, as closely as I can follow what Al has taught me. So the technique is the same.
Yeah, you try to teach everyone the same, Al?
Yes. You know, I played around with, you know, different variations of the procedure for a number of years and was able to figure out what worked and what didn't work, so I kind of fine-tuned it over time.
So I would assume that just with this procedure, you would both believe that the afterlife does exist. Is that pretty correct? Pretty accurate?
I do.
You know, I have my own personal beliefs. I'm always a little standoffish about that.
Really? Why?
Well, because I want to appeal to the largest audience I possibly can. You know, if I take a side and I say, well, you know, these aren't real or these are real, then I'm likely to turn off maybe half the population. My primary goal is to get healing to people who need it. So kind of strategically, I have kind of sidestepped the broader philosophical issue.
Well, now, okay, this is interesting because the goal is to heal someone. I would guess, though you may, I'm sure you care, but I would guess that your primary care is for the patient.
Yes.
Just to make sure they feel better.
Right.
They act better. And whether they believe that they're talking or communicating with their dead one or not, the point is, if it makes them feel better, that's the key to most of this.
Yes. Yes. You know, as I mentioned earlier in the show, it really doesn't matter what people believe beforehand. Atheists have the experience as readily as those who have the beliefs. But, you know, it's interesting, nearly or a very high percentage of people who have the induced experience believe that it is spiritually authentic and real. And but it's interesting that out of the small percentage who don't believe it's real, they say things, well, I think my brain just played a trick on me, that kind of thing. I just had this weird hallucination. Even though those people heal to the same degree. So beliefs, at least as far as my patients go, it really doesn't make any difference what they believe beforehand or even after the experience.
Okay, well, stay with us. Hanya, what's your schedule like? How long do you want to stay with us?
As long as you need me.
Okay, all right. We'll stay at least one more hour, and then, Alan, the final hour, we'll open up phone calls for you, okay? And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With a big question, of course, is what's the proof? What's the evidence? How do we know this is happening? We'll be back.